transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hello and welcome to the show. This week I am honored to welcome actress Eva LaRue from the hit television show CSI Miami. Eva is here to talk about her career on both CSI Miami as well as when she was on All My Children. She's also here to share her involvement in the fight against cancer. Former Special Forces leader Colonel Brad Taylor also drops in to talk about units like SEAL Team 6 who terminated Osama bin Laden. And finally, author Julie Rom lets us know what's it like to be a military kid in the armed forces.
Capture your need for sound.
If you're a fan of both daytime and nighttime television, you are going to know exactly who I'm talking about when I mention the characters of Dr. Maria Santos from All My Children and Detective Natalia Boavista from CSI Miami. That's right. The common denominator is that both these characters are portrayed by the amazing actress Eva LaRue. Eva, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much.
Eva, now, I have to ask you, was it a goal to be an actress since you were a kid? Because I always wonder where this sort of seed starts.
You know, it really was. I think from the time I can remember at about 4 or 5 years old, I was always the one in the neighborhood gathering together all my friends and putting on a show. And the show would move from living room to living room. So we were on a road tour of the neighborhood, with our little, you know, show.
The traveling show.
It was a traveling show, traveling circus show. And so I knew I wanted to be an entertainer. I always loved the triple threats in the business, the Shirley MacLaines and the Liza Minnellis and the people who could sing, act, and dance. And that's really what I always wanted to do.
Was it a wild ride for you to get the gig on All My Children? Because I know for a lot of people, All My Children is like the epitome of the soap genre.
Yeah, it was. It was... I had done Santa Barbara before that for about a year, and then I was born and raised in Southern California. So when I got the job on All My Children, it meant moving to New York, picking up and moving to New York, and I was 23 at the time. But I did it, and it ended up being the best thing I ever did in my life. And I have to tell you, after hearing that All My Children might be canceled, I cried so hard for about a day and a half because it was such a part of my adulthood. I mean, I feel like I grew up there on the show. I had dinner with Kelly Ripa and Mark Consuelos last week when I was in New York, and we were talking about it, and they said the same thing because, you know, they met there, got married there, had Michael, their first baby there. And, you know, I met my ex-husband there, John Callahan, and had my baby there. And, you know, it was just so much a part of our lives. And it's been on the air for 41 years, mm-hmm. and it's just such an iconic show. I can't imagine it not being on the air. And it's something that has been a part of so many generations. I grew up watching it with my mom, and my daughter watches it sometimes now with me when she's home sick from school, of course. And people ask me all the time, "Do you actually watch the show?" And I said, "Yeah, I watch the show at least twice a week. I have to check in and see what my friends are doing."
That's awesome, and I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I've had the opportunity to interview several soap actors in the past, and recently Sean Kanan from Young and the Restless, and also Eileen Davidson a few months ago from Young and the Restless. And at that time when I spoke to Eileen, you know, the word had not come down yet that All My Children and One Life to Live was sort of, you know, going down the wayside there. But, you know, I remember when I got into soaps hardcore in the early 90s, you know, there was like 12 or 16 of them. And now there's going to be 4. So do you
there's
feel...
There's going to be 4. And they're saying that this is going to be the last year of the daytime Emmys.
Oh, I didn't even hear that. So that's news.
Yeah,
to me.
That's what they're... I mean, that's the rumor right now. Because,
wow.
Well, what would they really have to...
compete.
You know, what's best show if there's only 4 shows?
Right. And so do you feel like the other 4 that are going to be left, like General Hospital, Young and the Restless, Bold and the Beautiful, Days of Our Lives, do you feel they're in danger of also becoming obsolete?
Well, they've been talking about Days of Our Lives being on the chopping block for, you know, just about every year for the past 5 or 6 years, I think. So I don't know what kind of shape they're in at the moment, or if that's still the going rumor. But, I mean, can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
It would end up being 3?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really sad to see the end of an era go. And I just really feel like there's still an audience for
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and something that Eileen mentioned, and I wanted to get your take on it, is Eileen had mentioned, because as you know, she's been on soaps for many years, and she said that, you know, originally back in the 80s and 90s, you know, soaps, the storylines that they were telling were really breaking new ground. Like, they were the first ones to cover, you know, interracial marriages or, you know, homosexual storylines. But now she feels like with the internet and everything, like, so much is being broken online before it even makes it to television. And she sort of feels, if, you know, to paraphrase her, it feels like that's why there's been a bit of a decline. Do you feel like that's sort of the reason as well, that soaps are kind of falling by the wayside, that they're not the first anymore with the storylines?
Well, I think not only that, but we've got so much reality TV that we can see that more ridiculous things happen. I mean, here people used to always say, oh, it's ridiculous what goes on soap operas. Not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, tune in to an episode of The Jersey Shore and you'll see that not necessarily is it that crazy. So, you know, I think people would rather watch the comings and goings of these other people and on reality shows than you know, watch daytime anymore.
Okay. And when you were, you know, in the thick of it, and you know, it was always said that you were a part of the super couple with your ex-husband, John Callahan, Edmund and Maria. Was there a lot of pressure on you when that was going on? Was it sort of surreal to be in this super, this power couple that was going on?
Yeah, it really was. And I remember at one point, you know, we didn't realize that it was happening. And we went to one of those super soap weekends that the ABC daytime people go to once a year. And it was at Disney World every year. And it was really fun. We'd go for 4 days and it would be a chance to meet all the fans. And it was really a blast. You felt like Elvis, felt like a rock star for 4 days. And we went and we saw these huge posters of us everywhere. And we kind of looked at each other and we're like, oh my God, we're a super couple. We actually made it into that echelon of couples were considered a super couple. I remember very specifically us having that conversation, like, oh my God, we did it.
And it's hard to do it because there's only a few of you that have actually managed to have that, you know, fan following.
But we didn't think that we were until we saw all these big, you know, posters of ourselves together everywhere. And we're like, oh my gosh, that's us.
And I know it's been a while since you've been on the soap canvas full time, but I'm assuming that you must have an ardent following still from your soap days.
You know, it's interesting because we have, they say, 20 million viewers for CSI Miami, which is so many more viewers than tune in to All My Children on a daily basis. But I think because All My Children ran for so long and I was associated with the show off and on for 10 years, I still, more people than ever come up and say, oh, I used to love you on All My Children. More people will talk to me about All My Children than ever talk to me about CSI Miami.
Wow.
Still, now.
And it's going to follow you forever, which is probably fine with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, which is awesome because the character, I loved the character and I loved the show and I loved my experience there.
And was it hard for you to leave,
associated
Eva?
With that show. I actually am lobbying to go back.
Oh yeah, good.
To do some episodes this summer before the show goes off the air. And I already told CSI that that it's what I want to do and they've given me the thumbs up. And I really, really want to be part of that last month of the show.
And before I jump into CSI, I just wanted to ask you, when you actually sort of left All My Children full time, was it hard for you to jump? Because it's almost like leaving all your high school friends, I would imagine.
Oh, it absolutely was. It was like leaving high school and you know, going off to college alone. You know, it was really, really hard to walk out that door.
Joining us on the show is actress Eva LaRue, who plays Detective Natalia Boavista on CSI Miami, and who also had a very successful run as Dr. Maria Santos on All My Children. Make sure to check out her website, evalarue.com. Now, as we mentioned, for the last several years, you've played this wonderful character on CSI Miami, Detective Natalia Boavista. Now, what's it been like as an actress portraying your character's growth on the show? Because it seems like you've come from point A, and you're definitely passing point B and into point C now.
This last year was really, really exciting for me. Emily Proctor got pregnant in real life, and so she had a beautiful baby girl back in December. And she decided to take it easy towards those last couple of months, and I got an opportunity to really... What ended up being funny is I ended up being sort of the resident victim. I can't even tell you how many times I got kidnapped or, you know, hijacked or what this season, but it was really fun. I got to do a whole lot more running and jumping and shooting and playing and doing and, you know, madness. And so it was really an exciting season.
And do you enjoy being involved in like the stunt stuff? Like, is it fun to be out there and sort of like you said, running and tumbling around?
Yeah, it really is. It's really exciting.
And I know that you have a lot of technical jargon to get through on the show. Was it hard, I guess, when the first couple seasons having to learn all this technical stuff that a lot of us have no clue what you're saying anyway?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? So many times I'm like, do I really? Is anybody going to know what this is? Please let me skip this word. It's the worst part of the job. I love my job, but the worst part of it is I feel like speaking in Chinese. I feel like it is speaking in a language that you don't know and will never really understand what you're saying. And that is by far the hardest thing for all of us on the show is the science speak portion of it.
And a question for you, because I think a lot of people don't really understand what it's like to be a part of a huge network show like CSI Miami. Can you just give us like a typical idea of your day when you're on set? Like if you are full on busy that day, like what time do you have to get up and how does the day sort of run?
The day is always different. So depending on how big your storyline is for that episode, it takes 9 days to shoot an episode. And there are 7 of us. So we all work about, we all work about 4 days an episode. But this last season, I worked more like 6, 7, 8 days an episode. So it was a lot more busy for me this year than it normally is. But it's really a lovely schedule. We work a 12-hour day. We're not like a lot of nighttime drama, 1-hour dramas where they work an 18-hour day or a lot of shows that my friends are working on. They call them fratter days because it's your day starts on Friday and ends on Saturday morning at 6 a.m. And so your weekend's shot because, they're exhausted and
right.
Sleeping through the day. We don't have that kind of schedule at all. We have a great 12-hour day. So, I have to get to work at about 6 a.m. And then it pretty much ends at 7.
And when you're on set, do you have time to get, because I just know by watching you that you're obviously a very active person. When there's a bit of downtime on the set, is that when you get your workout in?
No. Because otherwise you get all sweaty and you've got to go through makeup and hair again and everybody's mad at you. And there's never really quite enough time in between scenes to, get changed, work out and come back. So that is when it's hard to, when you've got heavy storyline and try to squeeze it in. Cause you don't want to get up at 3 in the morning and work out before you have to leave for it.
Wow.
So, and then at the end of the day, I want to spend time with my daughter when I get home and put her to bed and have some family time. So I try to do it on my days off and then I squeeze it in on the weekends as well.
Okay. Gotcha. Now I have to ask you this as well. Being a part of this, crazy, I guess we'll call it franchise of CSI, you're on CSI Miami. Are you guys like as a team from CSI Miami, a little bit competitive with your counterparts, from CSI and CSI New York? Because I keep thinking that you guys all sit there, watch the ratings and see who comes out on top all the time.
No, we aren't. I mean, I guess maybe we're all crosstown rivals or sibling rivals, but we don't keep track of what everybody's up to.
Okay.
We really don't. We see each other at charity events and parties and things like that. And everybody's obviously really friendly and everybody gets along great. But no, we don't really keep track of each other.
Okay. Now, I know that the season finale of CSI Miami, it was just broadcast, and your character was in a very sort of sticky situation at the end. I know you can't sort of tell us what ends up happening, but just a question for you. Do they let you know as an actress what's going to happen, or are you in the dark during hiatus as well?
I am in the dark during hiatus as well. Right. We're in the dark pretty much all the time until the script comes out the week that we're shooting it.
Oh, wow.
So we have no idea what's going on for our month. We get our scripts as the new episode starts, and that's the first that we know of it. And then I guess we shoot about a month ahead of what you guys see, so we know about a month, ahead of what you guys are viewing on TV.
Okay. And now, obviously, you guys are in hiatus now. When would you guys go back? July? Is that how that works?
We do. We go back second week in July, and then we start to air in September.
Joining us on the show right now is actress Eva LaRue, who plays Detective Natalia Boavista on CSI Miami. Check her out, evalarue.com. Now, Eva, something I've been wanting to ask you, for a couple years now, because I've seen it sort of all over the place. You're very involved, I guess, in the realm of cancer, if I can call it that. I wanted to ask you about, your latest involvement, which seems to be with the Beckstrand Cancer Foundation. Can you tell us why you're involved? And I know that cancer has like a personal connection to you and your family.
It does. I was doing a lot of work with the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition for a few years because my grandmother and my great-grandmother both died from ovarian cancer. And then I was doing some work with various research coalitions and awareness, cancer awareness coalitions, which are all very important. But when a friend of mine died from breast cancer 4 years ago, it was the first time that I realized or saw firsthand how absolutely financially devastating cancer could be. And this was a friend of mine from high school. So towards the end, we were doing, she's a school teacher, and my, she's married to a friend of mine from junior high, and he's a school teacher, and she had not been unable to work for the last couple of years. So we were doing all of these fundraisers, you know, pancake breakfasts and spaghetti dinners and things like that to help pay their mortgage. Because in, you know, once you've gone through all of the traditional treatments that are covered by your medical insurance, the experimental treatments aren't. And, you know, one of the pills alone that she was having to take five times a day was $33 a pill.
Oh, my God.
Five times a day. I mean, that's just one. You know, it's just unbelievable how expensive cancer can be. And if you don't have that, you don't have that second income, who's helping you pay your mortgage? Who is helping you with your groceries and your phone bill and your electric bill and your, you know, all of these things? So I was introduced to Beckstrand Cancer Foundation, and they come in, they are only regional, they're in Southern California, but I just became their national spokesperson for their scholarship program. So they come in and they provide scholarships for kids who have cancer or who have had cancer, because now, you know, a lot of times the parents have had to mortgage their house to help keep this child alive, and now there's no money to send them to college. So the national part of the program is the scholarship program. The regional part of the program here in Southern California literally comes in and helps them with everything. One of my friends from high school, her daughter has leukemia. They just started paying her house payment for the next 6 months. They come in, they give you food vouchers, they pay your electric bill, your phone bill, your rent, your whatever it is that you need for that 6 months that you're going through chemo and radiation and you can't work. They are unbelievable. They just jump right into the trenches and help you out.
And how can people help, like, get involved with this organization?
Well, they, if you're in Southern California and you need the help, go to Beckstrand.org. If you can help and you want to donate to Beckstrand, that's even more brilliant, because certainly there's so many people that need help. Or if you want to help and donate to the National College Scholarship Program at Beckstrand.org, that would also be amazing. So you can help in myriad ways.
And I wanted to ask you, because, you know, I have a lot of female listeners that listen to this program, and, you know, women, soccer moms, professionals, all that sort of stuff. Everybody's got a very busy life going on. But I know that, you've been very involved in the ovarian cancer and the breast cancer. What do you say to my working moms about taking care of themselves and making sure, you know, everything's up to par?
You know, you really have to be your own health advocate. I think that we put far too much trust in our first line of defense, which is our doctors. But I think that we blindly trust going in and they say, oh, I checked you out and you seem to be fine. And we go home and say, well, we're fine. Doctor said that we're fine. But you know in your gut that something's wrong. We all know when something's wrong because it's a persistent ache or pain or bloating, or you just know that something's not right, or you're fatigued in some way. Go and get a second opinion. Go to another doctor. Don't wait 6 months to do it, because it could be the difference between life and death. It could be the difference between a small growth and a large growth, between first stage and third stage. Go and get a second opinion. You have to be your own health advocate.
Eva, now, before I let you go, I have to ask you what's up next for you, because I think it's just fantastic that you spend so much time trying to help out with, this whole cancer situation and the various forms, and now with Beckstrand. What's up next for you with regards to this and also professionally?
Right now we're on hiatus, which is amazing. We're gearing up to go on a big family vacation to Africa for 3 weeks with the kids. And I cannot tell you how excited I am about that. We're going to go on the Great Migration and go to Kenya and Tanzania and Zanzibar. So I am insanely excited about that. And then we go back to work second week in July. And that's and right now, unfortunately, we had a lot of rains in Southern California about a month ago, and I ended up with so much damage to my house that I have no living room at the moment because my entire living room floor is pulled up, and and my whole backyard is jackhammered because they are so we're in a construction zone at the moment. And but it ended up being perfect timing because I'm on hiatus and my husband, who owns a commercial fishing company, he's on his hiatus at the moment. So we can pool our efforts and our focus and do all the house stuff that we need to do before we both go back to work.
Good for you. Well, Eva, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's actress Eva LaRue again, who plays Detective Natalia Boavista on CSI Miami. Check her out for sure at her website, www.evalarue.com.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
When we talk about the armed forces, much is made about the sacrifice of the soldiers themselves, that they're the ones that are putting their lives at risk for their country. While this is obviously very true and very admirable, a group of people that often don't get recognized is their families, the people that are left behind while their loved one goes off on their tour of duty. It's a stressful situation, to say the least, especially for children who are left to wonder and worry about their mom or dad. To give us an idea about what military life is like for children is author of Military Kids Speak, Julie Rahm, who is herself the daughter of a Navy veteran and married to a career Marine. Julie, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm delighted to be here.
So, Julie, to start off, because you were raised in this type of environment, can you sort of set the scene for us? You know, what was daily life like growing up on the base? And did you have to, you know, sort of move a bunch of times as a kid?
Well, fortunately, I did not have to move that many times. And I never got to live overseas, which, you know, now I kind of wish my family had that experience when I was growing up. But really, I didn't know there was any different way to live when I was a kid. But we did, you know, my father would come and go quite a bit. And when he would be gone quite a long time. And that was difficult because, you know, my mom would have her ups and downs then. And we would try to be really good to, you know, help her and take on extra responsibility. And there was a time, you know, when you're a little kid, you just don't have the full emotional processing ability in your brain. So one day I slept through my father's departure and it just ruined me. I actually got physically sick because I thought, how does Dad know I love him? I didn't get up and tell him that, you know? So it's those kind of things. And then fortunately, my father was never gone to war, but certainly my husband has been in his career lately. And so our daughters then got to experience that fear of, you know, is he coming back? Isn't he? Watching the news, getting scared and having to learn how to redirect their thoughts and get some emotional resilience to not think the worst, but think the best.
As a child in the military, do you ever get used to the routine of your parent leaving? And is there always this constant worry in the back of your mind that mom or dad might not come home? And I'm sure you've gone through this with your own children, as you mentioned.
Yes. And I'll say it's not constant, but it comes back. So we're able to get the children focused on other things and their schoolwork and their friends and their activities. And it's really about keeping them busy and focused on positive things that they're doing. And then nowadays, people can communicate so easily via email and Facebook, even with the soldiers abroad that are serving in a war zone. So we have amazing connectivity now with technology. So it makes it a little bit better to be able to say, okay, I'm hearing from him. You know, this feels pretty normal. And so, you know, we don't have to wonder because we get, you know, a regular email at least once a week, you know, that we get to hear from him. So, or her, sometimes it's the mom. So,
okay. And yeah. And a question, I guess, too, is does, you know, because I've always wondered this, does the military themselves sort of be supportive of the families? Do they help prepare you guys, you know, I don't even want to say it, but for the unthinkable, you know, that mom or dad may not come home? Or is everything sort of, you know, swept under the rug and you as a family unit yourselves have to deal with things?
They do have classes when a service member is going to go on a deployment. They have classes for the family members and usually the stay behind parent, not so much the kids. And, you know, really the parents and the caregivers are left to take care of the children and deal with that. So there's a little bit of coaching in a training program as to what to expect, but it's really not the nitty gritty. And that's why I decided to do the work that I do, because nobody really is there to coach the caregiver left behind on how to handle it day to day through the thoughts and emotions that they experience. So
okay. And can you explain a little bit about what you do?
What I do, well, my book, for instance, is my philanthropy. All the proceeds that come from that book go back to programs for military kids because they are my passion. And over $3 million in research has shown that children do well when their caregiver has emotional stability, resilience. It's really a linear thing. It's directly tied. If the caregiver is doing well, the child does well. And so what I do is I take, actually, after years of being a corporate trainer and coach in leadership, I bring those principles to the family, because really you have a strategic vision for your family, like you have a strategic vision for your business, and then you go about your day-to-day tactical activities. But when you have that overarching vision of why you had your family, why you married the person you did, why you wanted to have children, it sort of keeps things in perspective, and it allows people to remain a little bit more calm. And really also the other thing is, stress is really fear. So I really help people identify the true fear that's going on in their bodies, and then I teach them how to get rid of that, how to alleviate it.
Okay. And do you find, I guess, as a whole, that military kids are more resilient because of what they constantly face, or do they need more emotional and psychological support?
It depends. However, I will say that the ones who become emotionally resilient are some of the most resilient people I've ever seen in my life. And the book actually contains, the first half of the book is essays by kids and military families today that are ages 10 to 16, and they will show you through their stories how resilient they are as they tell these challenging stories and yet how they handled things. It's really inspirational. And yet there are some kids who really do need a little bit of extra help because maybe their caregiver doesn't have all the skills they need in order to help the child. So sometimes they really do need an extra boost.
Joining us on the line is Julie Rahm, author of Military Kids Speak. Make sure to check out her website, www.militarykidspeak.com. Julie, in your opinion, what does a kid in the military need the most when their parent is gone on a tour of duty?
Sometimes I think they just need a hug every day.
Okay.
And they need some empathy, even from the caregiver that's left behind. They need people to understand how the world looks through their eyes. And that's probably the biggest thing.
Okay. And if the unthinkable does happen where a child loses their parent, is there protocol on how it's handled, or and do they get assistance to sort of move forward in life? You know, because if the parent is gone, one of them, you know, I worry financially for them, like, will this kid have a chance to go to college?
Yes. In fact, there are very strong programs when the unthinkable happens. There are officers or military personnel assigned to the family that coach the caregiver through all the benefits and all the everything they need. There are people there to help. There really are. And even the other spouses of their commanding officer, their husband or wife's commanding officer, are trained in what to do. So there is a lot of training that comes from the military in what to do when the unthinkable happens. So they actually handle that pretty well. And there are a lot of programs that give college educations to children of deceased service members and even those who've just been seriously injured.
Okay.
And, so yeah, there's a lot of help and support at that point.
And I guess something I would want to sort of say or I guess ask a question is, you know, for someone like myself who is not in the military, you know, just a regular citizen here, you know, I feel like, you know, we appreciate what you and your family, you know, and all the, your fellow servicemen and women go through for us. But when things do go wrong, or even just, I guess, in general, I feel like we can't really understand what you as a family have to go through, because, you know, I'm not worried that my dad's gone overseas, because he's not, you know, like I have him. So are you guys very close knit, I guess, as a community? Because it feels like you guys really need to be tight to understand each other and to have the support, because us, meaning people like myself who just, you know, live off base, don't understand what you guys go through on a daily basis.
Yes, the military community is very close knit indeed.
Okay.
That's true. And so the challenge now is there are so many National Guard and Reserve members that have been called to active duty, and they might live in a community where they don't have that support. So those are the people who are really left to fend for themselves and, you know, have a community of people that really can't understand how they feel. They might try, but they just really can't.
And do you wish that people like myself understood you guys more? Like, you know, because I said I'm very passionate about the military myself. You know, I'm up in Canada. I appreciate what my armed forces does for us. I'm also appreciative of the Americans, because I feel like we're neighbors and we help each other out. But as a military family yourself, do you sometimes feel like, you know, you guys don't understand us.
Not really. No, I haven't really had that feeling too much. And most people in military families, I don't think really think about it that much unless people are just really rude about it. Occasionally, someone will say to a child something that's just inappropriate, or, you know, they'll see something in the news media that doesn't feel very good when they watch it, the way it's portrayed. But most of the time, I don't think military families really think about it that much, that the civilian world really doesn't know much about them or how they feel.
Well, I appreciate that, because sometimes I feel like we're not, you know, appreciative enough of what you, not to mention, you know, your armed forces member goes through. So it's nice to know that you realize we are supportive, but maybe we don't understand exactly what's going on. If you go, though, if we sort of touch on the government for a second here, do you think that there should be more help from the government for military families to cope with the strain of what you guys are under on a constant basis?
I think they are really working hard to provide that right now. I think when people need the support, it they can find it. And so, yeah, I think the government is really doing as much as they can right now for that. And I think it's coming to light more about the unsung heroes drafted at birth, these military kids. Because a lot of times we, as the spouses, we get recognition and all kinds of nice things. But we chose our lifestyle. But the kids didn't. You know, I was drafted into a Navy family, and I didn't know any different. But yet these are the junior ambassadors around the world, and they, there are a lot of good things that come from their lifestyle. They learn how to make friends. They learn about diversity. They become very worldly and insightful people at very young ages. So I think highlighting that and having the civilian community understand how special military kids can be is important. And that's the other reason that I wrote the book Military Kids Speak as well, because so much in the media we hear the bad stuff about the kids. Maybe they're left behind in school. Maybe they're struggling. But a lot of them are doing really great. I think it's important to show both sides.
That's awesome. And I guess after having written the book, I guess what's the biggest lesson you learned after writing that book? Because again, you've come from this world, but now you've actually, you know, talked to kids themselves. And how, you know, what's the biggest insight you got after writing this book?
Technology has really changed the game. They're able to stay in touch with their old friends when they move around the world. They can Skype and talk to their friends for free when they're, you know, move from San Diego to Sicily, Italy, or Japan with their families. And so it's much easier to not lose touch because of Facebook and technology, and also because of technology being able to communicate with their parent that's overseas as well. So it makes things it makes the world a much closer place.
And I guess
that's made a difference.
Okay, and a question too, you know, for civilians like myself, you know, if we, you know, were to come in contact with, you know, a military child, and you know, what do they like? How can we best be supportive of a child in the military? You know, let's say they were to take, you know, I don't know, like a karate class off base. You know, is it important for them to be in contact as well with civilians and see how we live as well?
Oh, yes, because really, in a lot of ways, there aren't that many differences. It's just that the child might get uprooted every few years and have to start over making friends and with activities. And, of course, the, you know, the deployments. But other people have traveling parents as well. They're just maybe not going to it. It's such a dangerous place. But it is. And I think what people could do is simply say, hey, you know, we appreciate your service, because the kids are serving too. And they might say, oh, it's my dad or my mom that's really serving. But just a little recognition that their, you know, their service matters too, because by doing well at home, it allows their parent to do well and not have to worry about them when they're focused on their job abroad.
And, you know, you've been in the military, you know, since childhood. Would you have ever have changed your path in life? Do you wish that you've lived, you know, a civilian life? Are you very content with how things have worked out for you and for your children now?
No, I wouldn't change a thing. And our daughters say the same thing. It's really it's a challenging lifestyle, but it really grows you into a person of character and integrity and teaches a lot of leadership along the way. So yeah, we attribute a lot of our success in life to the upbringing in the military.
And Julie, where can people get a copy of your book?
They can go to militarykidsspeak.com, or of course, Amazon or barnesandnoble.com as well.
Fantastic. Julie, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Kelly, and I appreciate you spotlighting great military kids.
Excellent. That's Julie Rum, author of Military Kids Speak. And again, check out her website, www.militarykidsspeak.com.
I put away the groceries and I take my daily bread. I drink. dream of your arms around me as I tuck the kids in bed. I don't know what you're doing, and I don't know where you are, but I look up at that great big sky, and I hope you're wishing on that same bright star. I pray, and I sleep alone, I cry alone, and it's so hard living here on my own. So please come home soon. Come home soon. I know that we're together, even though we're far apart, and I wear our lucky penny around my neck, pressed to my heart. And I wonder, I pray, I sleep alone, I cry alone, and it's so hard living here on.
Most of the world is rejoicing over the news that Osama bin Laden was not only found but terminated by a brave group of special forces who launched a quick and effective attack on his compound in Pakistan. Now, since bin Laden's death, the public has become fascinated by this courageous group known as SEAL Team 6. To give us some insight into a special forces unit like SEAL Team 6 is retired Lieutenant Colonel Brad Taylor, who served more than 21 years in the military, including an 8-year stint in the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment, Delta, where he commanded multiple troops and a squadron. Lieutenant Colonel Taylor is also the author of the book One Rough Man, a New York Times bestseller. Colonel Taylor, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, to start off, to the military community, what does it mean to have finally found and terminated Osama bin Laden?
Huge relief. When the news came out, originally when they were talking about it, everybody was saying he was going to talk about Muammar Gaddafi or something like that. And I thought to myself, there's no way that would happen because that'd be a NATO strike. The news would be out. Italy, France would already be talking about it. And I was going through my head, it's got to be something unilaterally did. And I thought, gee, I wonder if we got UBL. Just, I didn't think it had happened. When it happened, when I saw it on the news, I was like, holy moly.
Wow.
Great day.
And is this a special feather, I guess, in the U.S. military's cap that you guys were able to get bin Laden and not, you know, the British or some other United Nations force?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. If anybody had the news for him, I mean, if the SAS had come forward and said, look, we've located Bin Laden, and the only way we can get to him is for whatever reasons, is it has to be our force. We just said, by all means, go get him.
Okay, fantastic. So all of the forces are very supportive of one another, I imagine.
Yeah, especially at that level.
Okay. Now, Colonel Taylor, for us civilians who don't know, can you explain, you know, just how hard it is to get into a special force unit? Because from what I understand, it's, you know, exponentially more difficult than just making it into the regular armed forces, which in and of itself is already a difficult task.
It is. It's a pyramid. For instance, in my case, I started out in the infantry, went to Ranger School and that kind of stuff. And then I tried out for special forces, the nickname, the Green Berets, in the Army. And I went through selection process for that, the training course. And then tried out again for Delta itself, another selection process and another training course.
So everybody has to sort of work their way up.
Yes, especially for like SEAL Team 6. Those guys are handpicked from the SEAL community itself.
Okay.
So you become an ordinary SEAL. Like, you know, I guess I shouldn't say ordinary. You become a SEAL. And from there, you get handpicked to go to that unit.
Now, for someone who, like you just mentioned, you had gone through the infantry, is there like a time frame, like, you know, as you go into the armed forces, you know, from basic training to when you would become a SEAL or a special forces unit? How many years of training is that to sort of get to that elite level?
On average, in my timeline, is about 10 years to be allowed to. There's certain gates. What they want is a mature individual. They want somebody who can make decisions. You've already proven that you can shoot and do all that other stuff. But you can train quite a few people to do that. They want somebody who's got the capabilities to make decisions under pressure. And that comes through experience and comes through performance that you've shown. So it's a long road to get up there until they say, okay, at this level, this guy's got the capabilities to do it.
Now, I think a lot of people, you know, have misconceptions about what type of person, you know, I guess higher military personnel are looking for, you know, to be a member of a special forces unit. Now, you know, you watch these Hollywood movies and all of these tough guys come off as, you know, cocky and edgy and willing to take all these dangerous chances. I feel that, you know, that's not who you would need if you want to get your special forces team back safely. So what type of individual are you actually looking for to be in an elite unit?
Beyond anything else, they're looking for problem solvers. It's a mental game beyond anything else. The skill sets, you have to have a baseline skill set of being able to shoot and fire and maneuver and do combat actions, but they want somebody who's got the judgment and maturity to make correct decisions on the ground, because that's what's going to save you or not save you. It's a decision you make on the ground itself that's going to help. It's not necessarily your mechanical skills.
Joining us on the show is retired Lieutenant Colonel Brad Taylor, who is also the author of the New York Times best-selling book, One Rough Man. Check him out at www.bradtaylorbooks.com. Now, all the news reports are saying that the identity of this you know, SEAL Team 6 that took down Bin Laden is going to, you know, remain anonymous. Can you explain, you know, sort of why their names will never be revealed? And I realize that part of it's probably safety issues for their family.
Well, it's a classified organization. Anybody in the organization is classified. You don't know any given time. You don't know who's in the organization, who's not. And that's for security purposes, for training missions and things like that. People always say, you know, we have too many secrets and things like that. But the truth of the matter is, every time one tidbit comes out, it builds a bigger picture of the capabilities that the unit has, and that's the reason that they keep all that classified.
And
that's the reason you'll never see a complete rundown on how this mission accomplished, because, you know, we may have to do it again. We have done it in the past, and we may have to do it again. If some of the missions I'd been on, if somebody had just splayed them all over the news, then you could pretty much template how we're going to do the next one.
And obviously, these guys that sign on, you know, to be a part of this elite unit, they have no problems remaining anonymous. I think they themselves just know internally, obviously, what they've done and that they've helped their country.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the slogan of the U.S. Special Operations Forces is the quiet professionals, and that's because you get your satisfaction from getting the mission done. You have no desire or need to be anywhere out in the news as a celebrity or anything like that.
Okay. And I read in the news that, you know, being part of such an elite team is obviously a very stressful endeavor, and that a team member's sort of average time in a special unit is potentially averaging around that 3-year mark before they burn out. Is that true?
No, okay. That's not true.
Okay.
I spent, you know, like you said, I spent close to 8 years in Delta. People stay around. The truth of the matter is that if you leave the unit, there are some people who leave for a lot of times it's family reasons. A guy may want to stay, but it's too hard on his family and he chooses his family, which is an honorable thing to do. Or the guy may do something wrong and he's asked to leave. The average time is longer, much longer than 3 years.
And what was it like for you, Colonel Taylor, to, you know, command a special forces unit? I imagine it's a very challenging, you know, operation to command.
Oh yeah, definitely is, because you're definitely in charge of some of the smartest individuals I've ever known. All of them with capabilities that exceeded my own. And so they all have something to say about when you make a decision, you better be a right decision, because they're going to tell you in a heartbeat that it's not.
And can you explain, I guess, the difference, you know, because obviously you were part of a special forces team, so you were obviously out in the field for X amount of missions. What was it like to go from doing that to then being the man behind the scenes? Like, are you constantly, not worried, but I guess concerned and sort of, you know, itching to be out there with your team when you are behind?
Yeah, there's a little bit of, you know, when this mission went down, there's a little bit of maybe not jealousy, but man, I like to bet on that. But the day-to-day work is extremely grueling, and people are looking at this one mission and the one team that did it, but make no mistake, there were thousands of people that were trying to get this thing done. And there were probably, for this one mission that was planned, there was probably 100 others that were planned that didn't get executed.
Okay.
So my hat's off to those guys. They did a flawless mission, and it's a dangerous job that they did to penetrate a sovereign country and do what they did.
And like you just mentioned, there was obviously many, many people involved in all of this to make this work out. And I know, like you said earlier, it's difficult to sort of know, and then obviously the military does not want to put out all the steps that were taken to get where they got, to be able to get Osama bin Laden. How important is it for you guys in the military to have, I guess, your CIA operatives as well helping you guys and getting all that, you know, the information off the street so that you guys can perform your missions?
It's extremely critical. The feeds for the intelligence feeds come in from all sources, and we have a pretty good partnership. I see a lot of stories about, you know, fighting between the CIA and the military. And I'm sure there is some of that at the higher echelons, at the Secretary of Defense level, and Leon Panetta, the Director of Central Intelligence. But out on the ground, when the guys are out on the ground with CIA, SEALs, Army, doesn't really matter. You just want to get the job done.
And now that you've sort of, you know, retired from the military and you've turned to being an author, was it a difficult transition for you to leave the military?
It was. It was a very tough decision. I came out on the promotion list for Bird Colonel, and I'd been gone quite a bit, basically since 9/11, and my daughter was entering high school, and just a lot of different things that came into play when I decided to retire.
Okay. And for someone like you, Colonel Taylor, who has decided to retire and go back to, I guess, quote-unquote civilian life, do you guys have training or support groups that you guys can go back to civilian life? Because I know it's very difficult for the soldiers to go back. Is it something that you guys need to talk about as well, coming from a management level?
Yeah, but my situation is kind of unique because of the close-knit of the unit I was in. I mean, you never really leave. I can always go back, and I still have friends there and things like that.
Okay.
So it's not like just a private who had served 3 years and then went back to the street.
And how did you decide to become an author? That seems like not really a big jump from what you were doing, but obviously a different career path, to say the least.
Yeah, I always just wanted to write a book. It's just a goal of mine, and I'd left the unit, which was like being on a 200-mile-an-hour train, and my last assignment was teaching military science at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina, and then literally the train went down to about 10 miles an hour. I had just time on my hands. I was used to 18-hour days, and I just said, okay, what am I going to do now? And I said, well, I'll try to write a book.
And can you tell us about the book? Because it sounds, you know, very interesting. One Rough Man, again, a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, it's a military thriller. It's about actually what this mission just happened, terrorism and counterterrorism. It's got special forces in it. And people ask me, you know, are there any events in your career that you know, causes a catalyst for the book? And then there's not. It's a fiction book. And I specifically did not want to write about anything that's classified, so it's a fictional account. But there's a non-event that came to mind was, what would Al-Qaeda do if they actually came up with a weapon of mass destruction? And the conventional wisdom is they'd hit New York City or Washington, D.C. or something like that. But they want an Islamic caliphate, and they have definitive goals in mind. And I thought through, you know, what would be the best use of that? And that was the catalyst of the plot. Where would this WMD be used?
And I have to ask you, is it tougher to write a book to be an author or to be in the military?
I'll tell you what's tougher doing these interviews. I spent 20 years being the guy in the corner who never talked to anybody, was antisocial, and wouldn't tell anybody what he did because it's all classified, and now I have to put myself out there. It's a difficult transition.
And Colonel Taylor, where do people get a copy of your book?
You can get it at any major bookstore. It's Costco, Sam's, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. It's on Kindle. It's on iPad, on Nook. So anywhere where major bookstores are.
And I guess just a final question for you. You know, now that Osama bin Laden has been caught and terminated, obviously this is not the end of, you know, all this crazy terrorism that's been going on. What do you want to see, I guess, from, you know, your military, the Canadian military, you know, the world's military, in sort of making sure we're still on alert, I guess?
Well, I think there's going to be a definite psychological blow to Al-Qaeda, because terrorism exists on a perception of strength anyway. There's a reason there's Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They all took that name based on Al-Qaeda's perceived strength, which is headed up by Osama bin Laden. Because of that, they're going to have to show that they're still a player. They want that perception of strength to continue, and they're going to react. They're going to do something in retaliation. But there's no doubt that it's done a pretty good blow to Al-Qaeda. It'll help us both in Afghanistan against the Taliban and worldwide against the global threat.
Fantastic. Colonel Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for having me.
That's retired Lieutenant Colonel Brad Taylor, who is also the author of the New York Times bestselling book, One Rough Man. Again, check him out, www.bradtaylorbooks.com.
Bring on the remix.
CeeLo Green with Bright Lights, Bigger City, the Shapeshifters Heavy Disco Remix on the Kelly Alexander Show. Wow, what an awesome show. I had so much fun. I hope you did too. A big thank you going out to actress Eva LaRue for joining us, as well as Julie Rom and Colonel Brad Taylor. It was so much fun to have them on the show. Now, before I go, want to leave you in a positive frame of mind for the week ahead. So here is your quote of the week, this time from Ralph Marston. Quote, you've done it before and you can do it now. See the positive possibilities. Redirect the substantial energy of your frustration and turn it into positive, effective, unstoppable determination. End quote. Thanks again for hanging out. Always appreciate your time. Any comments or questions, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. Have a great week. I'll talk to you soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.